Hi gang, Barry here. Not done one of these for a little while. Hope you've been having an excellent year so far. God, how are we already halfway through March? Absolutely infuriating this time malarkey, isn't it? I hope those of you who celebrate had a very good St. Patrick's Day. In fact, we're covering saints in this episode. We've got one of our intermittent best of the worst episodes where we go back to old topics and talk about the best things in those categories rather than the worst, and we did cover best saint. So Patrick didn't get a look in against our candidates, have to tell you. Not as sexy nor as badass as those particular names we threw out. All of that and more in the episode ahead of you. But before you listen to that, a couple of bits of housekeeping. First things first, any of you who are in London over the next month or so, god damn it, I've done it again. I've got a play on and I've got tickets to sell. So here I am at the front line on my knees begging y'all to buy some tickets. My play Breeding, which ran at the King's Head Theatre in London last year, is back for a longer run in a brand new production, again at the new King's Head in Islington in London. Lovely new theatre. I've just visited there last week, and obviously when this comes out we will be in tech rehearsals. And yeah, it's a beautiful space, beautiful part of London. If you're in London or near London and you want to come see the show, please do. It's a play about a gay couple trying to adopt and their social worker leading them through the adoption process. But as the play progresses, various secrets and things emerge which reveal that all of these people have met each other at a very congruent moment in their lives. And it's funny, I promise. And it's moving, I also promise. And it should be one of those shows that if we do it right, we'll make you laugh and cry, hopefully leave you feeling a bit uplifted. And yeah, honestly, I'm so proud of it. I'm so proud of the team who are helping make it. So if you want to come along, I heartily, heartily encourage you, visit thekingsheadtheatre.com, I think is their website, or just click the link that I've sneakily snuck into the description of this podcast where you can buy tickets. And the show opens on the 21st of March. That's our first preview, and we're running till the 14th of April, so a good chunk of time. A couple of you came and saw the first iteration of the show. It would be lovely to see some more Worst Foot Forwarders in the audience this time round. And not only have I written the play, I'm in it as well. So if you come along, well, say hi to me in the bar afterwards. You get two for the price of one. You get on stage Barry pretending to not be me, and you get off stage Barry wishing I wasn't me. So, and here's the thing: if you can't make it to the show, one other little thing you could do is just click the link to the show website, which is in the description, as I said, and copy and paste it into your Instagram or your Twitter or your Facebook. Go do it now if you like, and you know, just put it out there to your friends and family saying, hey, heard about this show, I reckon it would be pretty good. We've got a lovely bunch of 4 and 5 star reviews first time around. So, you know, it's not just me telling you this, folks. But yeah, if you wanted to be my little army of Russian trolls spreading, in this case, I was about to say disinformation, but in this case, information about the arts, well, you'd be doing me a big favour. I've got a lot of tickets to sell, and I'm really proud of the show, and I want as many people as possible to see it. Ben saw it last time. He liked it. Go ask him yourselves if you like. You can ask him on social media. We're on socials. Ben is on @Vanderlaff. I'm on @BazMcStay on Twitter or @BarryMcStay on Instagram. And the podcast, of course, you can find on @WorstFoot all over the place. And also Worst Foot Forward on Facebook. And our website is worstfootforwardpodcast.com. And the email address is worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com if you like to make your missives longer than the permitted 140 characters or whatever it is these days. No, that can't be right. It's 280 now, isn't it? It hasn't been 140 characters on Twitter for ages. It's not called Twitter anymore. Like I said at the beginning, time passes and I don't trust it. Other than that, thank you as ever for everyone who supports the show on Patreon. If you are in a position monetarily to do so, visit patreon.com/worstfootforward and donate some monies to help us keep the show going. And you'll get lots of bonus content, extra interview stuff with our guests, and intermittent videos and videos of live shows and things like that as well. God, all sorts of stuff to get through when you do these intros. I'm a bit tired. I might sit down and listen to a podcast episode. Thankfully, there's one coming up right now.
Hello, Worst Foot Forward listeners to another BOTW. Yes, it's Breath of the Wild, everybody's favourite Zelda installment. Oh, no, sorry. It's another one of our Best of the Worst episodes, where we go back to subjects that we've covered in previous Worst Foot Forward episodes, and instead of looking at the worst examples of those things, we're looking for the best. This week, Ben and I are looking at episodes 111 to 115 from our back catalogue, where we looked at the world's worst smell, the world's worst algorithm, the world's worst manager, the world's worst design flaw, and the world's worst saint. Ben, there's a lot of fun stuff in there. I love a saint. We both love football. And trying to figure out how to find out what the best design flaw is was certainly a fun experiment for me. So,
yeah, it was pretty tricky, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I'm looking forward to diving into these. Episode 111, we talked to Sarah Jones about the world's worst smell, and the winner was my suggestion of thioacetone, which is a lab-created concoction which, when a small sample of it drops in a lab or a vial breaks open, it causes people in buildings 150, 200 yards away to feel nauseous. So how could we not pick something that's basically the world's best stink bomb? What did you look at for best smell, Ben? Did you go personal? Did you go scientific? What metric did you use?
I went sort of anthropological for my research. What do you think ancient Egyptians believed perfume to be?
Was it medicinal? I know when there was the plague, people thought if you sort of thought about nice smells or had nice smells, then that might help ward off the plague. So something medicinal?
No, they believed it to be the sweat of the gods.
Oh, even though Reg had made it down the perfumery.
Yeah, specifically Ra, which, you know, he's a sun god. That makes an awful lot of sense.
It's a lot of sweat.
A lot of sweat. They even had a god of perfume, Nefertem, which I like quite a lot. And then I looked at sort of smell and how it's used to communicate in culture. And I read this really interesting article that sort of suggested that in the West, in particularly, smell is like the most undervalued of the senses. It's reflected in our language, so that almost every colloquial term for nose is derogatory: the schnozzle, conk, hooter, snoot, snout, and that large and protruding noses are considered ugly. I mean, you could say, you know, I've got a Roman nose, but even that, it is noticeable and not commented on the way, particularly, you know, your skin or your eyes might be. Or, I mean, immediately you could go, oh, he's got a big ton. But equally, there's praiseworthy words to do with other senses. Visionary, a good listener, dexterity, good taste. There's no equivalent, really, of going, oh, what a finely tuned nose you have.
Only for, like really posh British aristocrats who might call something a rip snorter or something like that.
I mean you could say he's got, you know, like a nose for a clue or maybe in the detective world, but it's a bit of a stretch.
Yeah.
And then I found cultures where smell is prioritized. So the Andaman Islands, which are out in the Indian Ocean, there's the Ongi people, and their calendar is constructed on the base of the odor of flowers. So each season is named after a particular odor. And personal identity is also defined by smell. So when you refer to yourself, you touch the tip of your nose with a gesture meaning both me and my odor.
Yeah.
And in Ongi, when you ask, how are you, you say, konyune Onorangi Tanka, which means, how is your nose? etiquette requires that if the person responds that they feel heavy with odour, the greeter must inhale deeply to remove some of the surplus. And if the greeted person feels a bit short of odour energy, it is polite to provide some extra scent by blowing on them. It's delightful, isn't it?
Hang on, just let me fart on you.
Yeah. You've got both the Bororo of Brazil and the Sereretan Dut of Senegal. They associate personal identity with smell. So for the Bororo, body odour is associated with life force and breath odour with the soul. For the Dut of Senegal, they believe, again, that you're animated by two different scent-defined forces. There's the physical one associated with your body and your breath, and your spiritual scent, which is claimed to survive after death. And they believe in reincarnation, these people, so they can tell which ancestor has been reincarnated based on the similar smell. So, you know, you go up to the baby, go, oh, smells a bit like grandma. The two other peoples I looked at was the Dasana people of the Amazon, and they believe that all members of a tribal group share a similar odour, and marriage, therefore, is only allowed between people of different odours, which I guess is a good way of stopping intermarriage and making sure that different tribal groups work together.
Mm. So they divide the church into the bride's smell and the groom's smell, on the left and the right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Instead of a matchmaker, they just have a perfumier. And so this is also based on the exchange of dowry gifts. So if one family provides meat, then the other should provide fish or vegetables. It's lovely. It's almost like sort of like a wine pairing. Yes. with the smelling. And then the Batek Negrito of the Malay Peninsula take it even further. They say sexual intercourse between those of a similar order is prohibited, and even sitting too close to someone else of a similar odor profile is considered dangerous. Mm. In fact, it's even believed to cause disease, which sort of takes us back to a thing that you said about what people believe during the plague.
Yeah.
So that's sort of where my research took me, because, I mean, my choice for the best smell is very simple and very obvious. I went close with freshly baked bread. But of course, the greatest smell on earth is a smell that whenever I'm home in Newcastle on a Friday night at 6:30, it is the smell of my mum's roast chicken just getting to the perfect stage. I'd say this quietly because my wife is in the house. My wife does a bloody good roast chicken. A bloody good roast chicken. It's not as good as my mum's. It's like my wife is a far superior cook to my mum.
Now, listeners, I don't know if this has been picked up on the microphone, but Ben's shoulders have hunched up and his voice has dropped a few decibels because he really, really is tense admitting this.
I really am. I mean, listen, in the same way that we've spoken on the show before, that my wife and father-in-law, as people of Italian heritage, they have a deep and meaningful relationship with the tomato. My mother... as a Jewish lady, has a deep and meaningful relationship with the chicken. I don't understand it. I don't know where it comes from. The way my wife cooks roast chicken is great, and she slow cooks it.
Yeah.
And I mean, because my mum is pandering to my dad's rather basic and beige tastes, she does not introduce things like, I don't know, garlic and paprika to the chicken, as my wife does, and that is delicious. But the taste that my mum makes is great, but the smell, it is so comforting.
Mm.
And when it's mixed with, I mean, this is proper Proustian taking me back. That, the sound of the archers on the radio, and me watching either Star Trek The Next Generation or Ren and Stimpy on BBC Two,
yes,
is amongst my happiest places, because I know that roast chicken and roast potatoes and gravy with challah dipped in it is about to happen.
Yes.
And even in my most atheist moments, that smell will make me believe that I'm one of God's favourites.
Very good. Ben mentioned Proustian there. Marcel Proust in A la Recherche de Temps Perdu. But basically the entirety of this interminable novel is sparked by a character smelling a madeleine. It's the smell of the cook making madeleines that brings him back and basically sparks all of the book in flashback. And I mean, there's lots of lovely smells. I love the smell of a particular, like, good creamy milk chocolate or rhubarb and custard. I'm such a sucker for rhubarb and custard. Just the best. Rhubarb crumble and custard, I would have that every day of my life, but my husband doesn't like cooked fruit, and frankly, I'm not sure he's a keeper. But wow, we've both really dunked on our marriages in the space of 10 minutes of this episode.
It's what food will do to you, mate.
It is, yeah. But I did look at a scientific option for this one. And mm-hmm. The best smell, apparently across borders, across cultures, worldwide, it seems that it's vanilla.
No, it's not.
Well, Ben, you have to argue with various researchers who carried out this study at the Karolinska Institutet in Sweden, and they're Swedish scientists, Ben, so you know they're good.
But they're Swedish scientists, so they're quite a fan of eugenics. So I will...
Well, they did this quite an interesting study. They carried out this survey of various different people. I think it was 225 individuals from 10 distinct cultural groups. They had city dwellers, indigenous hunter-gatherers, people from traditional farming and fishing communities, and they were from the USA, Mexico, Thailand, Southeast Asia, rainforests, the Malay Peninsula in Thailand, Central America, the Pacific Coast. And what they did was they asked the participants to sniff 10 different vials of scents, and they presented them in random orders. And then they were asked to rank each of the vials from the most pleasant to the least pleasant. And even the vials that were going to the, you know, isolated regions, they took them to the participants rather than bringing them to, you know, an urban environment, so that they weren't being exposed to smells that they wouldn't normally be exposed to. So mm-hmm. they were trying to maintain a test laboratory condition as much as possible. And every single participant from all of the groups, didn't matter, they ranked vanillin, the main component of vanilla, as the top choice. The second favourite scent was ethyl butyrate, which is a bit like pineapple. And then the third one was...
I mean, that's insane, because pineapple is so disgusting.
It's fruity. It isn't actually the smell of pineapple. It's a fruity, slightly sharp, fruity smell. And then linalool, which is a floral scent, but it's in lavender and various other plants and things. And the least popular, that was third. And the least popular scent was always isovaleric acid, which is quite pungent. It's in a lot of cheese and soy milk and sweaty feet. It's whatever that compound is, that smell. And these ratings were consistent, like I said, in all the locations. And they found that cultural background only plays a small part in the odor preference. They felt like there was a bit of variation based on personal preference. But overall, the similarities across culture suggest that maybe there is a evolutionary reason for why we like certain smells and don't like others. What that is, they're not entirely sure, but was there some reason that knowing and liking and following a certain scent would increase survival chances at certain points in history or not? The guy who's leading the study, he said, "Now we know that there's a universal odour perception that is driven by molecular structure, and that explains why we like or dislike a certain smell." So like I said, there was a bit of personal preference, but the cultural impact was minimal. It seems that on a molecular level, we humans are designed to like certain smells and to not like others. And he said, "The next step is to study why this is so by linking this knowledge to what happens in the brain when we smell a particular odour." And I quite like vanilla, Ben.
I do not mind vanilla. Don't get me wrong, I love a 99 flake. I'd prefer it to fucking cost 99 pence like it used to. Proper good fresh vanilla, you know, when it's stuck in a pudding by someone who knows what they're doing, it's great. But and I think it is interesting how something like vanilla, which is I think I'm right in thinking is something like 70% of the world's vanilla comes from Madagascar, so it's quite a niche aroma. If you look at sort of the great span of human history, not many human beings have been to Madagascar.
Yes.
But it turns out that that's the one we all agree on. But the problem is, as delicious as it is, in the ice cream world, it's basically like going, my favourite colour is beige.
And had a bad rap from ice cream, hasn't it?
It has. And that is unfair. And it's good and delicious and it's great as an ingredient, but if you think that vanilla is better than my mum's roast chicken, I will get Deanna onto this podcast now and have you answer to her.
I am going to cede. Hell hath no fury like Ben's Jewish mother defending her roast chicken.
It really does not. And let me tell you, as I was talked about before, the Jewish afterlife contains 49 different levels. So my mum will bring down at least 47 levels of hell on your head.
So congratulations to your mum and her roast chicken for sweeping the board there. In episode 112, we talked to Andrew Somerville about the world's worst algorithm. And the winner was Ben's suggestion of Randy Olson's algorithm to make it easiest and quickest to find where's Wally or where's Waldo, taking all of the fun out of it and turning it into a scientific process. I'll be honest, I'm not a scientific man. I'm not a mathematical man. But I do love a story. And A quick Google of the phrase best algorithm led me to...
Don't reveal our methods!
I know, but it led me to learn about the fast Fourier transform. I'm sure there will be listeners of ours who know what a Fourier transform is and who Joseph Fourier is and will know exactly what this algorithm is. I'll explain it probably very poorly, but the story at the end of it is the thing that drew me to it. The fast Fourier transform is considered very, very crucial. It's used a lot in science, engineering, technology. And its predecessor was the Fourier transform, named after Joseph Fourier, who was a French mathematician in the 18th, 19th century. And what he would do, he would analyse his work focused on analysing periodic functions and representing them as an infinite sum of sinusoidal functions.
That's a function...
About the ear, of the ear, nose and throat.
Yeah.
The Fourier transform, essentially, this... algorithm he created is a mathematical technique that transformed a function of time into a function of frequency. Essentially, he could take a signal apart and put it into its component pieces. So if you were to imagine a sound engineer might have a sound wave that he wants to break up into, oh, that background noise and this foreground noise and this bit and this bit and this bit. So the Fourier transform essentially could be applied to that to help break up the components of that frequency, of that signal. But the Fourier transform, which was very widely used in lots of signal processing applications, was considered very complex. And so because of that, it meant processing large amounts of data presented significant limitations. Computation time was basically enormous the larger your data set was. So... in the 1960s, James Cooley and John Tukey, who were mathematicians at IBM, they developed the fast Fourier transform, which, you guessed it, did this a lot quicker.
Great.
And you can use it for, like I said, sound engineering, noise reduction, signal filtering, compression. We use that in editing the podcast. Digital image processing, so image enhancement, image compression, pattern recognition. You could use it for channel equalization, modulation. You can use it for numerical applications, solving differential equations, evaluating integrals, all sorts of things you can use it for. Considered one of the most significant algorithms of the 20th century, indeed of all time. But the thing that I liked most about it is how it possibly stopped the Cold War.
Go on.
So during the 1970s, the USA had a radar system called the PAVE Pause. It was designed to detect incoming missiles, and it used the Fourier transform to process radar signals. But as we said, that's quite inefficient. The larger data set you have to imagine, the slower the Fourier transform works, and the computational time required to process radar signals for such a, you know, a large area as the entire planet and the USA specifically, meant that basically by the time you detected incoming missiles, it would have been too late.
Mm-hmm.
The Soviet Union had a missile defense system which was known as Galosh, and that was much quicker. And so that would have been considered the scales very heavily tipped in favor of the Soviet Union. And, you know, the key to ending the Cold War seemed to be mutually assured destruction, mutual alignment in all areas of advantage and disadvantage and things like that. And so the USA realized, oh, we're behind here. And they turned to James Cooley, one of the developers I mentioned earlier. And they gave him $25 million and a top secret project codenamed Vela Uniform to try and speed up the Fourier transform algorithm to help them catch up with the Soviets on this front. And after years of work, they developed the FFT, the fast Fourier transform, as I said, and it was much, much quicker, and it meant the PAVE Pause system could now track incoming missiles in real time. The USA and the Soviet Union were on a level playing field when it came to missile defense systems. They were both on equal footing. This balance of power helped prevent nuclear war and contributed to the fact that they just went, you know what, none of us are going to win this. So for all of the scientific applications that are used day to day, also contributed massively to avoiding a cataclysmic global conflict. So while I may not understand it entirely, I appreciate its application.
Remarkable and almost impossible to beat. Well done. And not least because it was like, oh, great, we can pretend that the Cold War was won by maths rather than weapons. Albeit that you can't run a weapon without some maths. So my algorithm, I'm going to talk about a gentleman called Robert W. Floyd, a computer scientist and remarkably adept. He was a roommate of Carl Sagan, obviously one of the great science communicators of the 20th century. He was elected fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 1974. He received a Turing Award in 1978. So we're talking a big dog here.
Mm.
A little anecdote that I like about him before I tell about his algorithm. A colleague of him, Richard J. Lipton, told, and this is, you know, an incredibly adept scientist, and he says that we were once stuck at Chicago O'Hare Airport for hours waiting for our flight to leave owing to a snowstorm. And as we sat there, Robert asked me in a casual manner, do you know how to play backgammon? And I said, I knew the rules, but what did he want to know? And he said, well, since we're here for several hours, we should play a few games, for small stakes, of course. And then he reached into his briefcase and pulled out a backgammon set. And Lipton says, my dad taught me many things. One was to be wary of anyone who suggests a game of pool for money and then opens a black case and starts to screw together their pool cue. I figured this was a similar circumstance. Yeah. And it turned out that, you know, just casually, as very intelligent men do, Robert Floyd had been working very hard on the mathematical intricacies of backgammon and was basically a professional backgammon computer. And we played for very small stakes, and I learned a lot that day.
Yeah.
But the algorithm that I want to talk about, this is an algorithm about two pointers on a scale that move at different speeds through a sequence of values.
Mm-hmm.
And one value moves at two steps every time the other one moves at one step. Mm-hmm. And the purpose is to detect a loop, if one exists, in any iteration on the list. There's a paradox in it that you think that surely one set of values will always maintain a distance ahead of the other set of values, but it won't. And this is my very poor layman's terms way of telling you that this algorithm is known as the tortoise and hare algorithm. And I found that ever so pleasing.
That's very
and
cute.
Ever so delightful.
That sounds like the sort of thing that a composer like Steve Reich would be making music around.
Yes. Absolutely. So it's a cycle-finding algorithm of trying to mathematize sort of this great paradox. I forget who, obviously it's from Aesop's Fable, I forget which Greek philosopher came up with the paradox of, you know, that the hare will always remain ahead of the tortoise because by the time the tortoise has got to point A, the hare will be at point B, and then the tortoise will have got to point B, and the hare will be at point C, etc., etc. So I like the backgammon story. I like the name. Did it end the Cold War? No. And therefore you may have this one.
Yes. Suck it, Aesop. The moral of this story was, work harder at destroying nukes. In episode 113, we talked to Joel Samuels and Kyle Ross about the world's worst manager, and we very much focused on football. And the winner was Joel's choice of Claude Anelka, brother of Nicholas Anelka, who lasted 8 games in charge of Scottish club Raith Rovers, where he brought in failed French footballers from the lower leagues and talked about how he was going to revolutionise football. And I think his record was 1 draw and 7 defeats or something like that. Ben, who have you plumped for the best manager?
Kevin Keegan. Absolutely not.
Also, people who aren't interested in football, just skip ahead 10 minutes.
Well, no, please, really, really, please don't, because I'm going to talk about someone who I think I have spoken about on the podcast before, very possibly on this episode. I'm going to talk about Bella Gutman.
You did, I think, talk about Bella Gutman on this episode, yes.
Yeah, so frankly, apologies for repeating something I said 5 years ago. But his is a story that is worth repeating. So he is a Hungarian gentleman, born in 1899, born to Jewish parents. His dad, Abraham, and mother, Esther, were both dance teachers, and he trained as a dance instructor himself at the age of 16 years. And he also, I'm not quite sure when in his life, but also obtained a psychology degree. And I feel like that is sort of an origin story for the sort of football he played and the sort of forward-thinking approach he had was remarkable. He was a decent player. He played for his first team was Hungaria FC. He went on to play for Hakoa Vienne, who were the Jewish team in Vienna. And they play, this is a time when, and I appreciate this is an extraordinarily loaded word currently, Zionism was really coming to the fore as a progressive force amongst Jews in Europe. And I obviously don't want to get bogged down in the politics of that right now, but safe to say that Zionism in the 1920s was a very, very secular philosophy. It really didn't have the religious and very unpleasant right-wing connotations or racist connotations that it has now. And so to be part of a Zionist football team in Austria wearing blue and white colours and a Star of David was a remarkable and particularly brave thing to do, not least since he had to run away from his home in Hungary because that was a very anti-Semitic place to be. Hakoa Vienne went and played lots of exhibition matches in America, and he ended up staying there and playing for the Brooklyn Wanderers, amongst one of my favourite football team names of all time, and then the New York Giants and New York Hakoa, and then the Hakoa All-Stars, so, you know, Jewish teams. And he was a very talented centre-back. He then moved back to Vienna and played for teams there, and perhaps foolishly, he went back to Hungary in 1939 and played for Újpest FC. They have a big part in my heart as a football fan because Újpest Dózsa are the team that Newcastle United defeated in the 1969 Fairs Cup to win Newcastle United's last big trophy. So that's sort of his playing career. One last thing to say about his time in America, because this is a man who we could do a three-hour podcast about. Yes. As well as playing football in New York, he taught dance, he bought a speakeasy, he invested in the stock market, and then as anyone who did invest in the stock market in 1929 lost all of his money.
Oh, no.
Yes. 1938-39, as I was talking about just before, the most bittersweet of bittersweet years, because playing for Újpest FC, that's when he won his first trophy. He won the Hungarian League and the Mitropa Cup, which was a precursor to the European Cup. Straight after that, anti-Jewish laws were introduced by the Hungarian government, and that ensured that he lost his job. And the destruction of Hungarian Jewry at this time was horrifying. Tens of thousands of bodies were shot and dumped in the Danube. Most of Hungarian Jews were sent to Nazi concentration camps. He initially hid in an attic, aided by his non-Jewish brother-in-law, but then was sent to a forced labour camp near Budapest. And that was sort of, when I say the lesser of two evils, they're two horrific evils, but it was sort of from what I've read about, it was almost like he sort of had an inkling that this was a better place to be. He was tortured there. There is an interview with him where he said his surgeon learned how to torture people. He's described about, said, was I a footballer from the national team? Was I a successful coach? Was I even a man? Who cared? I had to forget about it all just to survive. He escaped from this camp in December 1944, just before he was about to be sent to Auschwitz.
Wow.
Which is just astonishing. I mean, there are so many stories of people, you know, escaping the jaws of death and going on to have great domestic lives. But there were bigger things in store for this man. So 1946, he joins Ceaușescu in Romania, and due to food shortages, he insisted he be paid his salary in vegetables. However, he walked out of the Romanian club, and you will notice this is a theme of his managerial career because a director attempted to intervene in his team's selection. He then succeeded Ferenc Puskás Sr., the dad of one of the greatest footballers of all time, as coach at Kispest AC, which is a Hungarian side. During that time, in 1948, he attempted to take off fullback Mihály Patyi for ungentlemanly conduct. That left the team with 10 players because substitutes didn't exist at that time. Encouraged by the captain, Ferenc Puskás Jr., the great player, the fullback remained on the pitch. And so Gutmann's response was to retire to the stands, read the racing paper, and refuse to coach the team. He then quit on the spot.
I love it.
It's great, isn't it? He moved on to AC Milan.
He's had a really good heel turn. Was that his, like...
Oh, God, yeah.
His lightning quick winger heel turn.
Well, he was... this is when we see the start of his true greatness. And it should be said, he's one of these people, sort of like Arsene Wenger in the 90s, when he turned up at Arsenal and was like, what is your diet? Pies, beer and fags? And was like, right, lads, time for some grilled chicken and pasta before a match, I think. When Gutmann played only a few games for the Hungarian national team in the 20s, great selection of teams he played against, Switzerland, the Saarland, Poland and Egypt. and he played in the Olympics. And he was so disgusted with the lack of professionalism and indeed that the hotel was used more for socialising than match preparation.
Right.
He protested by hanging dead rats on the doors of travelling Hungarian officials.
If Roy Keane had settled for doing that when he fell out with the Irish FA in 2002 rather than walking out on the team, if he just hung a rat on Mick McCarthy's door, we'd have been fine.
The thing is, like, I feel like Keane wouldn't have done anything so passive-aggressive. He'd have thrown a live rat at Mick McCarthy with a message sewn into its skin.
Yeah.
Anyway, 1953, he's appointed manager of AC Milan. And this is a time when AC Milan have three of their greatest players, Gunnar Nordahl, Nils Liedholm and Juan Alberto Chiafino. A couple of, I think, Swedes and one Uruguayan. At least one, if not two of them, had a better than a goal a game record. It was incredible. And Gutmann had them top of Serie A 19 games into his second season when a string of disputes with his board led to his dismissal. Now, this is, I'm afraid, one little blotting of his copybook for us. He told the press conference, I have been sacked, even though I am neither a criminal nor a homosexual. Goodbye.
I'm sorry. Now I'm thinking, wow, are you a criminal homosexual?
Yeah, exactly right. Listen.
Mr. Gutmann, why have you been sacked? I've been sacked, even though I'm not a criminal or a homosexual. What?
It's a bit much, isn't it? He's got
he minced out of the press conference.
Yeah.
A swag bag over his shoulder. Sorry,
yes.
No, a swag clutch clasped in his hands.
Full of vegetables.
Yeah.
He's got something of the Brian Clough about him. Because, so brilliantly, after this, he insisted on a clause in his contract that he could not be sacked if his team were top of the table. After flouncing out of here, he then returned to Kishpesht as a coach, and they went on a tour of South America. And during this tour, they played against Flamengo, Botafogo, and he decided to stay there and took charge of Sao Paulo FC. And he took charge of the team that won the Sao Paulo State Championship in 1957. Whilst in Brazil, he popularised the 4-2-4 formation, which he basically invented, and it was so impactful there that it was then used by Brazil in 1958 for when they won their first ever World Cup with Pelé and the team.
Yeah.
So that's his first big one. No Gutmann, no 4-2-4, no Brazilian champions, no Pelé. He then comes back to Europe and goes to Portugal, and he helps FC Porto overhaul a 5-point lead held by Benfica and win their first of three Portuguese league titles. However, the following season, he went to Benfica in a very Brian Clough move. He sacked 20 senior players, promoted a bunch of youth players, and won the league 2 years running. One of those players was probably the greatest Portuguese player of all time, Eusebio. He only heard about Eusebio after a chance meeting at a barbershop. Allegedly, he was sat next to José Carlos Bauer, who was one of his successors at Sao Paulo. He talked about a player that he'd seen in Mozambique, because that's where Eusebio was from. And he talked about him in such remarkable terms that Gutmann went, I've got to get this guy. Just astonishing. But the thing that Gutmann is most famous for is that with Benfica, he won the European Cup twice in a row. And this is at a time when basically the European Cup belonged to Real Madrid.
Yeah.
But 1961, they beat Barcelona 3-2. And the following year, they came from 2-0 and 3-2 down to beat Real 5-3. And he was held aloft by the fans. Not unreasonably, after this, he asked the Benfica directors for a pay rise, and they turned it down. And he left Benfica, and it is alleged that he said, not in 100 years from now will Benfica ever be European champions. And since then, Benfica have been in 5 European Cup finals, 63, 65, 68, 88 and 90. They have never won. And apparently, before the 1990 final, Eusebio went to Vienna and prayed at Gutmann's grave for forgiveness and for the curse to be broken. And it still was not. So,
wow.
For the enormous impact that he had, for discovering greats, for pioneering Brazil winning the 1958 World Cup, for dragging so many teams from into greatness, and for having possibly the greatest sporting curse of all time, and for doing this having escaped from the clutches of the Nazis, it has to be Bela Gutmann as the greatest manager of all time.
So, Graham Souness. It won't shock listeners to know that I'm a long-time listeners to know that I'm a Liverpool FC fan, and I was slightly shocked, not that shocked, but you know, surprised to learn that Jurgen Klopp statistically is Liverpool's most successful manager of all time. Mm-hmm. He has the highest win percentage as a Liverpool manager. If you look at trophies won, he doesn't quite match up to that. He's won 7 trophies at the club, whereas Bob Paisley I think won 20. But then again, Bob Paisley was there for 535 games. Klopp's been there for 466, or will have been, I think, by the end of the season. But his winning
record
is... He's
not really leaving.
Oh, he's leaving us. It's so sad. I can't even think about what we're going to do when he's not here.
It's all right. Xabi Alonso will say, oh no, he's going to Bayern Munich. What a shame.
I can't even bring myself to imagine a manager coming along who's not going to cuddle the players after they do well. Can't go back to cold, distant managers when we've got cuddly Klopp. But yes, he's only 3 other managers have led Liverpool in more matches than Klopp. Klopp's been at Liverpool since 2015 and is leaving this summer, as I said. He's also not just one of Liverpool's most successful managers, he's also the Premier League, one of the Premier League's most successful managers. The top 5 win percentages for Premier League managers is Arsene Wenger, who you mentioned, who was at Arsenal for the guts of 20 years, 58%. Jose Mourinho with 60%, Klopp with just over 60%, Alex Ferguson with 65%, and Pep Guardiola and his definitely financially stable, financially above board Manchester City team with 74%. And it pains me to say this, Ben, but I do have to cave that my candidate for the best manager is Alex Ferguson.
That's fair. That's fair.
The words caught in my throat as I had to say.
Mate, listen, the same as me. Like, he is responsible for probably the greatest heartbreak of my teenage years when Newcastle failed to win the title. No woman has broken my heart in the way that Alex Ferguson has, apart from possibly but she was fucking mental. Like,
names may have been changed to protect the innocent.
Names comprehensively were not. She is a bag of snakes.
I am going to bleep that in the edit.
All right, then. You go for it.
Maybe I should also bleep Alex Ferguson. Yeah. So people can't hear me admit that I picked a Manchester United manager. But it's hard to argue with. Managed 2,155 games as a manager, a world record. Won 1,253 of those at 5 different clubs, or 4 clubs and an international team. He was at East Stirlingshire for a year, St Mirren, Scotland briefly, Aberdeen, and Manchester United for 27 years, during which time he won 38 of his 50 trophies as a manager, which is also, I think, the most trophies won by an individual manager, high-level trophies. Just astonishing. And not... gave the world Beckham and Giggs and Paul Scholes and the Nevilles, and was responsible for, you know, guiding the early career of Cristiano Ronaldo, who's gone on to be one of the greatest players of all time. And it's sickening. I hate it.
It's the fact that he managed to reinvent the team so many times that's remarkable.
Yes, that for that length of time, you can't just build a success around one group of players. You've got to keep doing it over and over and over again. And yeah. The fact he was going to retire, I think, 10 years before he actually did, and did what he set out to do, which was knock Liverpool off their perch, which Liverpool were the team in the United Kingdom for many years in England in the English League, and Alex Ferguson came along and caught up with us in the Premier League stakes in terms of league titles. Not only that, though, I read about a couple of little facts about him, one of which, he played for the Scotland youth against Wales, where his direct opponent was Mike England, who went on to manage Wales.
Delightful.
And also, he, for all that I hated him and his team, he come from a good socialist working class family. He had a trade union background. He was a agitator on behalf of shop stewards when he was in his teens, and worked with the Scottish Players Union when he was playing. And when he was asked if he was going to become a manager, he said that there was something in me. Maybe my trade union background helped give me the ability to make decisions and to be able to present myself. But not only that, if you're thinking in a collectivist way, chances are your team might work for the collective greater good. But, you know, for all his left-wing credentials, he wasn't imprisoned by the Nazis. So,
do you know what? The only reason that happened is because the Nazis were too afraid of him.
Yeah.
I would pay solid money for a remake of Escape to Victory where Alex Ferguson is the manager, just headbutting Nazis, giving them the hairdryer.
So for all of his statistical greatness, who could argue with Bella Gutman? Welcome back to the podcast, and in rightly the world's best manager. In the World's Worst Design Flaw episode 114, we talked to Jonathan Chariot, and the winner was Ben's suggestion of the Cochrane Revolver, a turret gun which had chambers that opened in all directions. So if there was a small explosion in one of the chambers, it sent bullets flying out literally everywhere, including back towards the person firing it and those standing around. So not a great design flaw. I tried to find something that was invented because something had a flaw, which then prompted the thing to be re-engineered. A kind of invented by accident route. And smoke detectors were invented by a Swiss physicist called Walter Jaeger in the 1930s. And he was actually trying to invent a sensor that could detect poison gas. And he was fidgeting around with this thing. And what happened was his device registered the smoke from the cigarette he was smoking and started going off. And that made him go, oh, poison gas aside, if this detects smoke, that has very obvious applications. Mm-hmm. And here we are, what, nearly 100 years later. Beginning in the 1950s, they were installed in industrial spaces. And then technological advances meant by the 70s, you could start installing them in homes, because they were, at that point, the price was such that most people could afford them. 12 million smoke detectors were sold in America in 1977 alone. These days, 9 in 10 houses have smoke detectors. And there's all sorts of different surveys which disagree or agree. But you could be so anything from 4 times less likely to die in a house with a smoke alarm to maybe they reduce the risk of dying by more than half. 40 to 60% of fire deaths occur in homes without a smoke detector, apparently. The trying to estimate how many millions of lives they have saved is probably impossible. But in terms of something that was meant to be a toxic gas detector and having a flaw that had meant cigarettes made it start to to alarm, and then going, wait, I could change the world with this, I think that's a pretty good design flaw. So, I mean, they're annoying. Why do they have that type of battery? Nobody knows.
No one knows.
The only thing that uses that battery, and remote control cars sometimes, the big cuboid ones, and they're annoying, and people ignore them. Apparently, there's some survey that says something like over half Americans will ignore all smoke alarms when they go off, and they are responsible for freaking me out the most when I was staying in a hotel once, because a smoke alarm went off in the hotel, and do you know when you're sleeping somewhere unfamiliar and you're woken up suddenly and you're like, where the fuck am I?
Yes, that's most mornings.
That, but also the where the fuck am I is accompanied by a shrieking siren. So genuinely one of the worst middles of the night of my life. But yes, I had to go with the smoke detector.
Really, really hard to go past that. I went down a similar route. The two that I found, one very similar, is that a chap called Wilson Greatbatch. Do you know what Wilson Greatbatch invented?
I don't know, but I love his name.
Great, innit? So he was working on a device to monitor and record the sounds of the human heart. And he popped a transistor in his device, but it was much more powerful than he normally used. And the mistake was it couldn't monitor anything. And instead, by putting in the transistor that was so much more powerful, it created electrical impulses. And it turned out that those electrical impulses perfectly emulated the beat of a heart.
Oh.
So instead of monitoring the heart, he created the first ever pacemaker.
That's cool.
Yeah. So it's it was a perfect thing. And obviously it's been worked on over the years to get smaller and smaller and smaller. His first prototype actually ended up being implanted in a dog, of course. it was then first put in a human who was 77-year-old man who lived for 18 months and then a younger recipient who lived for 30 years with his.
Wow. I had to work so hard to resist the watchdog reference.
Very good. Very good.
30 years, the second one. That's great.
Yeah. And obviously the trick was the hardest thing with pacemakers is to, because there's electricity in them, to make sure that the bodily fluids couldn't get in there and short the circuit. Mm. So he kept developing that and developed lithium batteries that lasted 10 years. So you wouldn't have to, open up a person's chest by pushing down on it and sliding it away and then making sure that you got the pacemaker the right way up. So you would have the positive and the negative on it. And you'd have the little springs inside the person's cavity. And it's all very difficult. Mm. He was looking at me, he's going, that is all bullshit, Barry. and in the end, he did so much work there, he ended up with 350 patents to his name. And today, there are well over 3 million people who benefit from his inventions. So, tempted to put him forward in the spirit of what you said, but I also briefly want to talk to you about Alfred Fielding and Max Chavanez, who were attempting to develop a type of textured wallpaper. And to do that, I don't know why, it was the 50s. It was all the rage.
And they invented the COVID vaccine.
No, they put two shower curtains together through a heat-shrinking machine to try and develop this. What did they develop instead by mistake?
Lamination.
No, but you're not far off.
Linoleum?
Nope, no. Bubble wrap.
Bubble wrap!
And it just so happened that in that era, IBM were looking for ways to protect delicate computer parts, which obviously were enormous at that time. And so they hit on this great invention of having created something that was basically useless to become one of the most important and fun pieces of packaging of all time.
Yes. Oh, great stress reliever.
Yeah. So bubble wrap or smoke alarms?
Oh, smoke alarms.
Yeah, all right, fair enough.
Much and all, we've all enjoyed rolling around in bubble wrap. I imagine bubble wrap has killed more people than saved people's lives.
That's fair.
Finally, in episode 115, we talked to the great ABK, Alistair Beckett King, about the world's worst saint. And the winner was my choice of St. Julian the Hospitalier, patron saint of murderers. What did you look at for this, Ben?
Looked at a bunch of women. Saint Quiteria is
I love Saint Quiteria.
Yeah.
Such a big fan.
Yeah, one of nine sisters. Mm.
Non-uplets, apparently.
Non-uplets, indeed. Their mum was a very high-ranking lady, but she was disgusted to have given birth to nine children.
Or like, another I version goes, was she was worried that it looked like she'd be, like, it was infidelity, that there were like lots of men's babies in her at once or something.
I love it. So she demanded that the nurse take the babies and drown them in the river, which she went to be like Power Moses. And
you've been Power Moses. That's her wrestling move.
Oh god, yeah. Surely that's parting the seas. but the nurse was like, I can't do it. So she took them to a remote village. They grew up together, and they formed a warrior gang. So basically, they're the biker nuns from Mars. Basically, they went around breaking Christians out of jail.
Yeah, they'd all been told that they should marry various Roman suitors. They were in Portugal, and Rome was under the Romans. Really, yeah. Portugal. And yeah, they said they didn't want to marry any of these Roman men. They were going to be bandit vigilante ladies.
Yeah, and this was like really, really early Christian times when there's, you know, basically Christians were still a small sect. So they spent the rest of their time, if they weren't breaking Christians out of jail, they were going around destroying, being iconoclasts and destroying statues, or basically just waging guerrilla war against the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
But eventually they were apprehended, they were killed, Quiteria was beheaded. And her and two of her sisters, Marina and Liberata, became saints.
Yeah. So the other six must have been furious.
I mean, what are you going to do? What are you going to do, man?
I like the article I read describes her as essentially the leader of 9 identical female Robin Hoods.
Yes. So I love that.
Make that movie.
God, yes. I mean, yeah, it's time for a new Marvel universe, really, with them, isn't it?
There's 9 of them. You can have so many spin-offs.
So many.
Forget Madam Web. What are you doing fucking around with that nonsense?
Yeah. So I'll be honest, read that, didn't bother with anything else because it was just too perfect.
Oh, she's so good. I love it. Yeah, it's you know, obviously pinch of salt, probably not true, probably lots of local legends mixed in with it as well. I liked Kateria, but obviously I've gone gay for this. And I picked Saint Sebastian. Are you aware of Saint Sebastian's iconic look?
No. Did he,
Saint Sebastian is depicted a lot in art, and is one of, even if you don't know that it's Saint Sebastian, you will 100% know you have seen him in paintings.
Does he have a particular halo? Is he wearing nail varnish? Is it, what sort of a glow up is it?
It's a glow up where he is dressed in a loincloth, tied to a tree, and has arrows sticking out of his body.
Yes, that's your man. Okay,
listeners. With any passing sort of knowledge of art, we'll have seen a Saint Sebastian of one version or another. He had to be killed twice. That martyrdom that we see so much in art of him with the arrows, that was the first time they tried to kill him. He was a Christian during the time of Diocletian, who people might know had led lots of persecution against the Christians. It's the end of the 3rd century. And he had to keep his Christianity private, like a lot of people did, and he was a prison guard and a soldier, and he quietly would convert the prisoners to Christianity while he was in there, and then converted the prison warden, who set all of the newly converted Christian prisoners free.
Wow, okay, nice. That's incredible.
Yeah, Sebastian was found out and was sentenced to death, and so tied to a tree, riddled with arrows by a firing squad, and he survived. And he went right back to visit Diocletian to tell him he was being a prick. And was then, beaten to death.
Good.
Yeah, murdered twice. His feast day is January 20th.
Is that like triple baked chips?
Yeah.
Thrice murdered saint.
His feast day is January the 20th, and old mosaics, if you see him, tends to be an older, bearded, clothed warrior type, you know, prison guard, how you'd imagine. But in the Renaissance, you start to get this depiction of him as a young, smooth-faced, nearly naked man. Because, you know, if he's wearing armor, then you don't get the arrows going and piercing his skin. And you can sort of link him to Christ's side was pierced when he was on the cross. And similarly, Sebastian's side has been pierced by the arrows. You get to see him, you know, as this youth. So, you know, there's hope depicted him. And also, you've got the plague. And a bit like we mentioned earlier on with the scents, beautiful things and fragrant things were thought as medicines, if you like, as defences against disease. So seeing a beautiful Saint Sebastian in your icon or in your painting might be helpful for warding off disease. And because he's passively enduring these arrows, you often get a sort of feminine type of feature to him as well, because femininity was considered to be passive. And so he gets curly hair and red cheeks and beautiful lips. So essentially, you're getting quite a hot Saint Sebastian.
Yeah.
In legend, you'd have said you thought he might have looked like a hedgehog with loads of arrows. In some of the paintings, there's like 3 arrows very tastefully stuck in him. and he, like I say, he's very, very Christ-like. But even at the time, there were concerns of people going, are these images a little too sexy? They're worried that it would evoke, you know, sensuality rather than religious, you know, fervor.
That's why don't kink shame a saint.
Yes. And then there's loads of depictions of him. One of the most famous ones, and one that's became fascinating to lots of later artists, was painted by Guido Reni in the 17th century. And this version was in the Palazzo Rosso in Genoa. And in 1877, during Holy Week, Oscar Wilde was with friends in Genoa and went to visit the Palazzo Rosso and saw Rainey's painting. He recounted how he just saw a lovely brown boy with crisp, clustering hair and red lips bound by his evil enemies to a tree and, though pierced by arrows, raising his eyes with divine, impassioned gaze towards the external beauty of the opening heavens. And if you cannot see why that would appeal to Oscar Wilde, of all people, for multiple reasons, then this bit's maybe not for you. He later went to visit Rome and visited the grave of John Keats, Wilde did, and he wrote in The Grave of Keats, "The youngest of the martyrs here is in lane, fair as Sebastian and as early slain." So already, within weeks, he's drawing the parallels between, like, dead artists and this this youth, and obviously later on in life when he went through his own trials, he saw a link between himself and Sebastian, because when he was in exile, he would call himself Sebastian Melmoth. So he was identifying with the martyr and who he had seen depicted as a beautiful youth in very sort of erotic ways. And other people, similarly, Thomas Mann and Yukio Mishima in Japan, also queer, and in their work they found the links with Sebastian. Mishima, I think, recreated one of the Sebastian paintings in some of his own work. And during the AIDS crisis in the 1980s, various different artists included Sebastian in their work. As one of the most famous ones was David Wojnarowicz, who was a New York artist, and he includes images of Sebastian in lots of his collage work, and again the suffering of the gay people at a time when people were ignoring them, pierced by arrows, and particularly as young men suffering. The link was even greater. And I think as recently as 2018, Aquaria, who won RuPaul's Drag Race in the US season 10, appeared in an outfit inspired by Saint Sebastian as well. So
I mean, what
Saint Sebastian as a drag icon, yes. So as the queerest of saints in what is, let's admit it, a religion where the men dress up in dresses and wear lots of bling anyway, I'm going for Saint Sebastian.
Are we going for a 9 warrior women or the queerest saint in history? That is tough.
Oh, I kind of want them teamed up.
All right.
I want the MCU.
Of Saint Sebastian and his 9 ninja saintlets behind him.
Yeah.
All right, done.
Kateria and Sebastian. Kateria versus Sebastian, then. Civil War. That one's going to come up next. So, yes, thank you, as ever, listeners of Worsford Forward, for joining us on this little reminiscence episode. We'll be back with a regular episode with a guest in a couple of weeks' time. In the interim, why not go back and listen to those 5 episodes, episodes 111 to 115. Give a shout out to our guests from the time. If you are interested in following any of our work, you can find us on @WorstFoot on all the social medias. You can find Ben on @Vanderlaugh, and you can find me on @BazMcStay on Twitter, or @BarryMcStay on Instagram. And if you have any suggestions of guests and things that you'd like us to cover in the podcast coming up, you might have to head to our Patreon if you want to suggest a topic, patreon.com/worstfootforward. Or if you want to get in touch with us with guest ideas, I know people have been batting some around on our Discord. The link to that is in the podcast description below. Meanwhile, Ben and I are off to start our first draft on Saint Sebastian and Saint Kateria. Meet Bella Gutman. Thank you for listening to Worstfoot Forward. Goodbye.